Well, I'm a little worried about what I say might ruin that selection of songs now at this point. That was an excellent way to bring our minds to thinking about these sorts of things. And this is a lesson that is, I think, kind of come about for obvious reasons. If you were here Wednesday night, and I know a lot of you weren't, we've got a lot of visitors, and we're really grateful that you're here. But if you were here Wednesday night, you remember the insanely long list of announcements that I had. Guy struggling with cancer yet again. Greg was homesick. Adam was out of town at a funeral. Tom was in the hospital. And, of course, the church in Osprey losing their preacher suddenly to a drowning accident. And just, it seems like everything hit all at once. And I know that wasn't even everything that everybody else knew about as well. And I was called upon to go down there this morning and fill in. And so I got to thinking about what I could do that was kind of on point, because I didn't want to dodge the issue. I thought it was important to talk about it. And then as I thought about it, I thought it would be a good thing to talk about here as well, because we're seeing a lot of those things. And a variety of us are connected to that congregation in one way or another. Many of you, who, especially those of you who are students, know Andrew, the son of Nathaniel, who passed away. And those of you who work at the college know him as well. And of course, Tom and I have been going down there off and on when they were between preachers, helping them out. Before that, Guy Warner was going down there several years back and helping them. So there's a lot of ties between us and them. And I thought maybe it'd be something worth thinking about here as well. I imagine that most of you, who are members here at least, have heard me talk about some of these things before that we're going to talk about here as we talk about the issue of suffering and the bad things that happen in this life and where they come from and why they come from. And I know some of you who are students that had my evidences classes have heard some of this, perhaps framed a little bit differently. But I don't at all hesitate to talk about it again, because this is a reality of our life constantly. The fact that we look around and see these things happen, it seems to come in bunches at times, as it has this past week. But even when it's not hitting us all at once, it is a constant in our lives that bad things happen, that suffering happens, that there's pain and sickness and death in the world that we live in. And I want to reflect on that some today. Now, from the apologetic side, which is not what we're going to talk about this afternoon really at all, but it comes up quite frequently as the problem of evil. That's how it's talked about. How can an all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing God let all of these evil things happen? And I bring it up just to say that it's really not that convincing of an argument on an intellectual level. When you look at it just intellectually and logically, it falls apart pretty easily. And you can pick it to bits relatively easily, because it's just not that great of an argument on that level. But the problem that we face as believers is not the intellectual level, but the emotional level. However easy it is to refute logically the problem of evil, it is far more difficult when you're actually in the midst of suffering. And I know that probably everybody in this room has known someone who is a person of faith that abandoned their faith because of difficult times. Their suffering, the suffering of someone else, suffering in the world. And then sometimes it's just pure selfish, God doesn't do what I want God to do. And sometimes it is very sympathetic and empathetic toward other people. But one way or the other, it's that emotional level where this becomes a problem. You know, maybe when you're a student at Florida College and you're surrounded by all of these people of a shared faith and you're studying the Bible regularly, everything's great. But then one day you're a young parent with a third child, you're working 60 hours a week, your wife is sick, your boss is riding your back, and you just found out your mom has cancer all at the same time. And suddenly the intellectual refutation of the problem of evil goes out the window because the suffering is there in your life. Or maybe that's not where you are. Maybe you're older and your friends are beginning to die and your body's beginning to break down and you hurt in places that you didn't even know were places, and it never seems to stop. You can't sleep at night. You can't stay awake during the day. You can't see what you used to see. You can't hear what you used to hear. All of those things of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, talking about the body breaking down. And it becomes harder at that moment. And it is the emotions that are the problem. It just so happens, coincidentally or providentially, one way or the other, that I was reading something, not at all thinking about preaching a lesson on this, just a week or so ago, and came across a couple of quotes that I thought were fantastic along these lines. And I want to share them with you as we get into this idea. This is from Oz Guinness' book, God in the Dark. He says, "Emotions are that part of us most vulnerable to outside influences, and in this sense, they are the part of us most easily manipulated. Our understanding can be persuaded not to believe, and our conviction can be broken, but when we are under pressure, our emotions tend to throw in the towel long before our understanding or our will. This gives us the impression that the emotions are a problem because they are weak, but it is just a reverse. The real problem is that they are too strong. Not only are our emotions easily influenced, they are highly influential. Once persuaded, they become powerful persuaders. And here is their danger." Guinness goes on to quote C.S. Lewis, who says, "Supposing a man's reason once decides that the weight of evidence is for believing in God, there will come a moment when there is bad news, or he is in trouble, or is living among a lot of other people who do not believe it, and all at once his emotions will rise up and carry out a sort of blitz on his belief. Now, faith, in the sense of which I am using the word, is the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted, in spite of our changing moods." I think that's a really good way of thinking about faith, at least from this sort of perspective as you think about this topic, is that you have an intellectual faith. You have a knowledge of what you believe and why you believe. You've considered the evidence. You found it compelling. But then life happens, and life gets ugly. And what do you do then? How do you hold on to that faith? And that's why I think it's helpful for us to reflect on suffering. To give this thought, not just now when we're in the midst of suffering, but also at times when we're not. To shore up our intellectual side, to shore up our faith, so that when our emotions want to carry us astray, it'll be a much harder job for them to do that. Now, I've got modest goals today in the 20, 25 minutes that I have left at this point. We are not going to answer once and for all the problem of evil. I'm not going to here in just a few minutes give you a silver bullet that's going to solve every emotional difficulty related to suffering that you're going to face for the rest of your life. That's just not a possible sort of thing to do. I can't prove beyond all reasonable doubt God's existence or His love or anything else just here in a moment. And to be clear, I'm certainly not trying to say here that emotional responses are a bad thing, or that emotional responses are improper, or that emotional responses should be bottled up. That's not at all what the Bible shows us. In fact, the number of laments in the Bible, not only in the book of Psalms, but especially in the book of Psalms, show us that it is good and right to have a strong emotional response to bad things and to pour those things out before God in prayer, even if it doesn't sound like the sort of thing we think we should be praying to God. That's what those show us. So I don't want to give the wrong impression that we should just kind of sweep it to the side. I just want to think through the difficulties that we face calmly and rationally, to try to bring our emotions under the control of our reason, to further establish our reason when the emotional onslaught comes yet again. And that's really all I'm trying to do as we think about these sorts of things. And so as I reflect on suffering, I want to talk about a few things quickly and then one thing a little bit in more depth. The first thing that I would think about is to remind us as we look at suffering that we have a limited perspective and that we have limited understanding, and that not everything that appears to be evil is necessarily evil in the broader scheme of things. And this is something I think we all understand very well in a variety of ways. We can think about this from a biblical perspective. And you look at the life of Joseph, for example, and how he was sold into slavery by his brothers. And as bad as that was, that actually kind of worked out okay in Potiphar's house until Potiphar's wife accused him of rape, and then he was thrown into prison. And that is prison, but things were going okay even there until he was forgotten about for a couple of years by someone who owed him a massive favor. But ultimately, things work out and he's in power. But as he looks back on his life later on, his response isn't, "Hey, this is great because I'm powerful now." It was, "This is great because this has been the working out of God's plan that I couldn't have even begun to understand at the time that it all began." He says, "God meant this for the saving of life. You sold me here, he tells his brothers, but God sent me here. And in that perspective of retrospect, he looks at all the suffering that he had endured and sees that it turned out to be a good thing after all. Paul goes through something very similarly in Philippians chapter 1, where he's talking about his imprisonment there in Rome. And he says, this has worked out for the best. This has worked out for very good purposes. Because I've got a chance to preach to the Praetorian Guard that I wouldn't have had a chance to preach to otherwise. All of the brethren have been emboldened by my imprisonment that they're preaching with more zeal. This is all working out great. And don't forget that the this he is talking about is an arrest for something that he didn't even do, a couple of assassination attempts on his life, being a political pawn and accessory in prison and forgotten about for several years, being forced ultimately to appeal to Caesar, which might lead to his death instead of his freedom, the shipwreck along the way. I mean, this has been miserable. If I'm writing that letter, I'm saying, dear Philippian church, you remember when I was falsely imprisoned in Philippi over in Acts chapter... Okay, he wouldn't have said that. But you remember when I was falsely imprisoned and God sent an earthquake and set me free? Dearest brethren, start praying for an earthquake because I need to get back out there and preach the gospel some more. That's not at all what he does. That's not what he says. He looks at the situation in much more close proximity than Joseph was and sees the good that is coming out of it. And we have all had that kind of experience as well, right? Suffering, illness, death, and looking back on it and seeing that our greatest spiritual growth came in that moment. Time and perspective changing our view on things. We've probably also all experienced the moment where we look back at something that we had prayed so fervently. God, please let this happen. God, please let this happen. God, please let this happen. And it never does. And 10 years later, you look back and you say, God, thank you for not letting that happen. Quite frequently, that shows up in your late 20s or early 30s when you've been praying fervently about someone of the opposite sex being the person that you're in a relationship with. And looking back going, oh my goodness, if I'd been married to that person, what a disaster that would have been. But if it's not that, it's something else. We've all been through that. Where we realize with greater time and greater perspective that something good was going on all along. There's an analogy I came across. I think I saw this first in one of Lee Strobel's books, but I might be wrong about that. But it just stuck with me because I think it's such a good perspective on this issue. He gives the analogy of a hunter coming upon a bear that is caught in a bear trap and wanting to set the bear free. He feels empathy toward the bear. He sees the pain that it's in and he wants to set it free. And so he tries to win its confidence, but how do you win the confidence of a wild bear? But he takes some food and you know, tries to show that he's the bear's friend by showing it some food. But of course, that just looks like that he's taunting the bear because you're caught in the trap and look at me, I've got the food. And so he takes out his tranquilizer gun and shoots the bear because he's not going to win its confidence. And now it really looks like he's the enemy of the bear because he just literally shot the bear. And what's the bear going to understand other than that this man shot me and inflicted more pain on me? And now it's beginning to lose consciousness and the world's going fuzzy. And how much worse is that? And now the hunter approaches him to set him free, but the bear doesn't know that. All he knows is that he's inflicting more pain because the only way to release a bear trap is to tighten it more to release the catch in order to let it go. So from the bear's perspective, every single thing that this man has done has been to cause it pain. Yet in reality, everything that he has done has been to set it free. And if we can look at that illustration and understand that the bear just can't get it because it's a bear and not a person, how much wider is the gap between me and God than between me and a bear? If I can look at some things in my life and find some good that have happened as a result of those bad things, is it not possible that from God's vantage point, there is good in all of it? That He knows what we do not know? That He sees the good in all of the pain? That if He could, He would just say to us, just be patient. I'm just trying to set you free from this trap. It's going to hurt for a moment. But just wait until you see how much better it is on the other side. Well, secondly, I would point out that some pain, at least, has value. And this is not something that we typically think about, at least not in a conscious way. We're aware of it, but we don't think about it a whole lot. But pain does good for us. I mean, the bear illustration is just one more of those. He had to endure the pain in order to be set free. But there's a sense in which our world would be so much worse if we didn't have pain. How on earth can you possibly say something like that? Well, that last time that you happened to bump the stovetop when it had just recently been on, and you remember how awful that felt, and you got your hand off of there as quickly as you possibly could, how could that be good? Well, it's good because it's better than leaving your hand sitting there for 30 minutes, leaning on it while you talk to your mom in the kitchen. The pain receptor said, get off of here in a hurry. And it saved your hand is what it did. Or if you sprain your ankle severely, and the pain that you endure as it heals, keeping the weight off of that foot, keeping you from doing all the things that you would normally do, have that kind of injury, and then continue running and jumping and playing and everything you would do otherwise, and that foot would be lost eventually. Someone talked to me this morning at Osprey outside the building afterwards and said, hey, I've got another illustration of that. It was someone that he knew who had diabetes and had lost feeling in his feet. And one day he was sleeping on the couch and woke up, I apologize for the image, but to find that a dog had bitten off about half of his foot because he felt nothing and it didn't wake him up. The pain is a good thing. It drives us in the direction of things that we need to know. There's a sense in which, and we can't apply this to everything, I don't think, but there's a sense in which pain is a gift. And maybe that in itself is kind of this analogy, to stop and think about how pain and suffering can be a gift in an even broader spiritual sort of sense. A third thing that I would think about is the fact that evil is ultimately, I believe, an evidence for God, not an evidence against God. Because anytime someone reacts with outrage over evil and suffering, he's presupposing that there is a real difference between good and evil. You stop and you think about it. What is evil? What is suffering? What is right? What is wrong? What is just? What is injust? What is fair? What is unfair? All of these sorts of ideas are rooted in the concept of some standard of what is good. And what is not that is what is wrong. What is not that is what is evil. What is that? What is not that is what is wrong and unjust and unmerciful and so forth and so on. But what could possibly be this standard of ultimate goodness that everyone can look to and agree upon that this is what is ultimately good and right and just and fair and loving and merciful? Well, that is, to some degree at least, the fundamental definition of God Himself. If you take God out of the equation and all you're left with are the blind forces of nature, if all you're left with is a world that is going on however it's going on, where the strong survive and the weaker chewed up and spit out, why would you ever look at anything and say, well, that's not fair? Why would you look at anything and say, that's not right? That's not just. That's not loving. That's evil. You take God out of the equation and all of those words lose any meaning whatsoever. You might not like it, but you can't give it any sort of moral quality at that point. There is no more moral quality to anything at that point. You see, the person who says something is not right, the person who says that something is not fair, believes on at least some level that what is right and what is wrong corresponds to something that is real, a supreme good of some kind. If there is no God, there is no standard. If there is no God, there is no good. If there is no God, there is no evil. And this is the level where this problem of evil becomes as big of a problem for the unbeliever as it is for the believer. You have to somehow be able to explain why you feel the way you feel about these sorts of things. But really what I want to spend the rest of our time talking about is what is kind of a common sort of standard answer to this, but I want to focus it not just on the issue of free will, but on particularly the perspective of sin. That sin is the cause of evil in the world. And we need not forget just how pervasive sin and the effects of sin are in the world that we live in. And I think it's an easy thing for us to forget how thoroughgoing the effects of sin are in this world, even though we see it all around us all the time. And I think part of the reason why we hesitate to equate sin and evil is because we see a few things in the Bible, and we then kind of overextend those truths into realms where they don't necessarily fit. So, for example, we look at Job's friends. You remember Job's friends, right? Job's going through, like, the worst possible period of life that he ever had, and that beyond which most of us could even begin to imagine enduring. And they're like, yeah, Job, you're a sinner. That's why this happened. And we think, yeah, that's not good. That's not the right kind of perspective to have on these things. And in fact, God comes down and condemns them, and we say, well, you know, that's wrong, obviously. You can't equate sin and suffering. Or you think of John chapter 9, where Jesus' disciples are walking along and they meet this man who was born blind, and the disciples say, who sinned that this man was born blind? Was it him or his parents? And Jesus says, you guys have no idea what you're talking about. That's paraphrased, but that's basically it. It has nothing to do with sin. This man was born this way so that the power of God might be displayed. In the very moment that Jesus is about to perform this miracle in that context. And we say, well, obviously Jesus says it wasn't because of his sin, therefore there's no connection. And while it is abundantly true that Job did not suffer because he sinned, and this man was not born blind because he sinned, that does not mean that we can therefore, you know, toss out all connection between suffering and sin. And it's an overextension of those ideas that gets us to that point. So how would I say that sin is the cause of suffering? Well, first of all, very quickly, in a most general sense, I think you can say that sin is the cause of every bit of suffering that has ever existed. Because in Genesis 2, there was no sin and there was no suffering. And in Genesis 3 through Revelation 21, there is sin and suffering. I mean, in that most general sense, obviously, the sin that brought death and suffering and the curse in the world has certainly brought suffering into the world. But even more specifically than that, I think we can connect sin and suffering in a variety of ways. So, for example, sometimes suffering is a natural consequence of sin. There are times where the connection between suffering and sin is as abundantly evident as possible. If someone decides one day they're going to rob a bank, and they go rob the bank, and they get shot while they're robbing the bank, that person's suffering is a consequence of the sin that he was engaged in. If someone has decided to live a life filled with promiscuity, and they get a venereal disease, that person's suffering is a direct result of the sin that they have been participating in. It's a natural consequence of that. It is clear. And so, yeah, there are times where it is obvious that the suffering is directly connected as a consequence of the sin that they were engaged in. But of course, that's not all the time. That's not every bit of suffering, and so we need to move on from that. Sometimes suffering is a punishment for sin. I think we're right in saying, be cautious about Job's friends and listen to what Jesus said, and not walk around pointing at people saying, you must be suffering because you've sinned. Obviously. But does that mean that no suffering is ever a consequence or a punishment of sin? Well, you might ask Nadab and Abihu about that, or Ananias and Sapphira about that, or Miriam about that, or any number of other people, the prophet that Dan talked to us about on Wednesday, about that. Loads of people were punished because of their sin, and they suffered as a punishment for their sin. You think of what Jesus says to the lame man that he heals in John chapter 5. Stop sinning, lest something worse happen to you. Now there you don't have the suffering itself, but there is the threat of suffering as a result of sin. So it's a possibility that he might suffer even more because of some sin in his life. So yeah, it's certainly possible that when we suffer, it's a punishment for sin. Now that's not for us to go accuse other people. That's an occasion for us to be introspective about the suffering that we're enduring, I think is the best way to think about that. Third, sometimes we might suffer because we're a part of a sinful group of people. We may not be guilty ourselves, but the group that we're a part of is guilty, and because the group is suffering, we suffer along with them. I've mentioned before my 8th grade science teacher who liked to say, if you ride without laws, you die without laws. The idea that if you get caught in the robber's den who held up that stagecoach when the posse shows up, even if you weren't robbing them, you were swept away with all the outlaws. To be more biblical, you might think of Achan and what happened to the Israelite army after Achan sinned. The group had been contaminated by sin, and they all suffered as a result of the sin that had happened to the group. And this is another spot where it's hard to say. You know, is God judging America right now with this disease? We can't say for certain. Was God judging America on 9/11? We can't say with certainty about those things, but it's certainly a time for reflection. We do know that our nation is a sinful place, like all places are. We do know that our nation as a whole seems to be drifting farther and farther away from God. And so when suffering comes, we certainly should reflect on this. But it's hard to pin down exactly and say, yes, this is definitely what is going on. But I do think it's a nice segue into thinking about the next idea, which is suffering to bring repentance from sin. C.S. Lewis said that pain is the megaphone that God shouts through when he really wants to get our attention. When we need to direct our life in a different sort of way. Again, to bring this to the biblical text, you think of Hebrews 12, which talks about God disciplining us and the trials that we endure being heavenly discipline, and how just like we don't like it when our parents discipline us, but ultimately we realize it was for the best, so also it is with our trials, that it is heavenly discipline to bring us to a better place, to be better people. Or you think of Luke chapter 13, where Jesus talks about the tower that fell down and the people that died. And do you think they were so much worse than everybody else and that's why this happened? No, Jesus says, I tell you that unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. That suffering that those people endured was to bring about widespread repentance of sin in other people. And so suffering can sometimes be what leads us to repentance from sin. Fourth, you might think of, that's not fourth, that's fifth, suffering to keep us from sin. And this is similar, but it's more of the preventative rather than the reactive or the punishment or the discipline along those lines. But sometimes God lets us suffer just enough to resist some temptation that we're going to face in the future. The classic case of this, of course, is Paul's thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, where Paul says, to keep me from becoming too proud about the visions that I'd experience, God made me suffer. So that ultimately I'd realize that it's not about me, it's about Him. It's not about my strength, it's about His strength. And when I am weak, that's when I'm strong. And it is the suffering that Paul endured that kept him from becoming the proud, boastful, sinful person in that regard. You might think of Jesus even, who we're told in Hebrews 5, learned obedience through what He suffered. Or James chapter 1, and the trials that we endure, which make us perfect and complete. That is what, in the language of 1 Peter, purges away our impurities, burns it away, and makes us refined in our faith. You might also think about how sometimes you are truly innocent, and you're not suffering as a sinful group, but you are suffering at the hands of another sinner. You think of Naboth, perhaps, one of the truly righteous people in the northern kingdom, one of the few righteous people in the northern kingdom. Here's a man who doesn't just refuse to sell his land to Ahab and Jezebel because he was greedy. He understood this was the plot of land that God had given his family as an inheritance, going all the way back to the Levitical law. Here's a man who knew God and knew God's law, and he wasn't going to give this land away. And so he got murdered. You think of a child whose mom uses drugs while he or she is in utero. or who is otherwise abused. You think of the victim of the drunk driver. You think of those who Jesus talks about on the Beatitudes who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. It's not their sin that causes any difficulty in their life. It's not that they need to be stopped from sinning or changed from sinning or that they're part of a widespread sinful group. But they're suffering at the hands of other sinners. And when you look through this, these first six ideas, the last two are a little bit different. But you look through these first six ideas, and again, I think it becomes abundantly evident to us just how pervasive sin is in the world. And just how connected, not just broadly, but in a variety of very specific ways, how connected suffering and sin are with one another. And if nothing else, every occasion of sin or of suffering should remind us of the presence of sin and the need to have the problem of sin removed. Well, then I would think also about those who have suffered for the good of other sinners. And this can happen in a variety of different sorts of ways, but sometimes the righteous one doesn't suffer because of someone else's sin, but for the benefit of the other sinner. Again, you think of Joseph, who realizes ultimately that the harm that they meant for him was meant by God for the family's good, to turn this little family into the nation that God had promised. You think of Paul, whose imprisonment led to a more fervent teaching of the gospel, and how good is that for the sinful world that's hearing the gospel for the first time? Or, of course, you think of Jesus, who suffered for other sinners. And the thing about Jesus, when you think about him, is he, just about all the way down the line, can fit into every one of these categories. No, he wasn't punished for sin, not his, but he was punished for sin. It wasn't a natural consequence of his sin that he died, but it was a natural consequence of sin that he died for our sin. He suffered to bring repentance. He suffered to keep us from sin. He suffered at the hands of other sinners, and certainly he suffered for the good of other sinners. Here is the only sinless man who ever lived, who brought together all of the different kinds of suffering in that one person. And I think that reminds us ultimately not just how great he is in his life and in his victory, but how great he is in his death and what he has taken away from us. He suffered not just to understand our suffering and become our high priest that can sympathize with our every weakness, as the author of Hebrews talks about, but ultimately that by his death he could become the perfect sacrifice to remove our sins at his first coming and to remove all of our suffering when he comes again.